nothing that I gotta prove. You think your words will make me black and blue, but I think I'm pretty with these old boots on. I think it's funny when I drink too much. You try and change me, you can go to hell. 'Cause I don't wanna be nobody else. I like the chip I got in my front teeth, and I got bad tattoos you won't believe. So kick out the jams, kick up the soul, pour another glass of that rock and roll. Turn up the band, find the hole, gonna lose control tonight. What do you want from me?
Oh, another day, another inappropriate sexual workplace firing. I know, that was not a good positive. You know what? Let me do that again. That was not a positive. You got to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative, which is like especially the eliminating the negative part. I think that's what we try to do on this show just about every day. But we're going to get to that. Of course, we're going to get to that. Matt Lauer fired by NBC News over inappropriate sexual workplace behavior. That's on the way. And who, not surprisingly, the comments on and the reaction. The comments and the reaction online, at least, never read the comments. They tell you that all the time. Don't read the comments. The comment section is where, like, the lowest of the low go to spout off from their parents' basement, usually. Do you think I can just not get sucked in by that? I can't, because you guys are right. I am a mouthpiece who really likes to have the last word. So biggest blessing, biggest curse. So we'll talk about that. Matt Lauer being fired by NBC News. And, of course, the reaction again.
Not all men. It's not all men.
Yeah, thanks, we know. Thanks. You know, well, from women, though. The ones from women are the ones that get my goat. They get my goat hard. And we're going to discuss that coming up. Also, we are going to be joined by Tara Havlethwaite today. She is a former Miss Oktoberfest who is an activist and has a passion for her community and for bringing transparency and the right to discuss issues regarding mental illness. And she has a very engaging, quite a sad family story to tell. And I noticed she posted about it yesterday, and I asked her to come in to discuss it because I know that it would mean something to her family to talk about her brother and mental illness and how it encompasses lives, sometimes, of course, the entire family. So we are going to talk to Tara Havlethwaite, who will join us coming up. Did you hear this reporter, the Montreal Gazette reporter, who called Shania Twain a tramp and then tried to apologize and then made it even worse? We'll talk about that, too. Lots to get to. Also, let's start here today, just before we get to one of our favorite guests, who is Sarah Bosfield from Chatelaine Magazine. Have you guys seen the thing about the upside-down Christmas tree, Polly? Have you seen this upside-down Christmas tree?
Internet is apparently it's the newest thing. I don't understand it.
The internet is upset by people having the audacity to turn their Christmas trees upside down. It's been a weird year, right, Polly? It's been a strange year. There a lot of places are doing this just to be kind of quirky or kind of whimsical, I suppose. The people who like the upside down Christmas tree say it's good for ornaments, like the ornaments tend to hang better. People with cats, Polly. People with cats say that the upside down Christmas tree or the Christmas tree hanging from the ceiling is wonderful to keep your pets out of the. Do your cats climb the tree?
No, they don't. No, I mean, okay. We don't have a real tree, so I don't know if that makes a difference, though. But no, they don't.
Some find it artistic. Other people saying it's disrespectful. Why is it disrespectful? Goodness gracious! Talk about snowflakes. Those are the people who are snowflakes. Who is it disrespectful to if you decide you want to have like an upside down, tipsy turvy, like, I don't know, Alice in Wonderland sort of kind of Christmas thing happening? Upside down Christmas trees, they're the thing, and the internet's mad. Also, they cost, if you want to get the one that's not, like, you don't hang this one from the ceiling, it's simply upside down on a stand. So it's still on the ground, it just looks like the letter V, the shape of a V instead of the shape of an A. $1,000, that's how much they cost. It's pre-lit, though. It's pre-lit. And such a conversation piece. I have a lot of questions. I mean, why is it upside down? I don't really know. Just to be different, I suppose. But my bigger question is, why is it $1,000? Could we just do this on our own? I don't know. I don't know if I'm missing something there, but internet's upset about today. We're upset about upside down Christmas trees. That's the problem in the universe today. 9:09, and it is time to talk about this story that I read the other day in Chatelaine magazine. You can find it on chatelaine.com. We can tweet that out for you at JenCampbell77 in just a moment here. Joining us to talk about the Renfrew County murders is Sarah Bosfield, senior writer from Chatelaine magazine. Sarah, good morning. Thanks for coming on with us.
Good morning, Jen. Thanks for having me, as always.
Love to have you always, and not a fun story to talk about. It's a terrible story just by itself, but I think the point you make that is so important in this story, too, is that this case was not an anomaly. Everyone knew that Basil Borutsky?
Yeah.
You know, you had this horrible, lengthy criminal record. Most of that record involved, abuses against some of his intimate partners. So could we have seen this coming? Maybe not in the hugeness of him killing three people in one day. Mm-hmm. But you definitely talk about, you know, that this is not an anomaly.
Yeah. So what happened was, in the midst of the federal election in 2015, there was a shooting spree, basically, in a rural community west of Ottawa. This guy got up 7:30 in the morning from his apartment, went to the home of a woman who he had been trying to get closer to, and she had rejected his advances. He'd been helping fix up her cottage, confronted her, wound a coaxial cable cord around her face and her neck and killed her and left her. And then he had his gun in a car and stole her car, actually, and took the gun and then went to the home of two other former partners and shot them at close range. They died basically immediately. And then he was sort of captured by police a few hours later. But let's see, like, that was in a 2-hour period. He killed three women. And we heard barely anything about this. And this was, you know, no politician spoke about it. There was just nothing. The trial, he had a triple homicide trial. He didn't actually participate in the trial. He didn't plead anything. He didn't plead guilty or not guilty. He didn't hire a lawyer. All this money in the justice system for this trial. And he confessed to police the day after his capture to killing these women. And he was found guilty on Friday of first-degree murder and the deaths of two of them, and second-degree and the death of one of them. And so I had been looking into this piece, and what we wanted to do was sort of point out that every, on average in Canada, every 6 days, a woman is killed by her intimate partner. And these cases do not make the headlines in the way that other murders do. And so we just thought, like, there's something messed up about that. Like, let's talk about this, especially as we seem to be more attuned in our society in talking about violence against women in new ways, but we're not talking about this. So it was an opportunity to point out how common this is, how easy it is actually for men to, you know, like Basil Borutsky, to slip through the cracks, despite a lot of measures that have been put in place. We're just not good at it yet, and there's a lot of reasons for that, and a lot that needs to sort of be rethought to protect these women a bit better.
I mean, and there's some just astounding details that you talk about and bring to light in the article. Like, for example, you talk about one of his victims each morning attaching a panic button to her belt.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was there was no surveillance on him, despite that crazy lengthy record of continuously breaching probation in the same way, and being violent and having weapons when he was banned from that. Didn't seem to be any kind of follow up for that.
Yeah, one image we have in the piece online is a picture of his firearms license, which he still had on him when he was arrested, despite being subject to a weapons ban. And so, but you know, he could conceivably have just gone into a store and bought ammunition and with that license, despite being subject to a weapons ban. And that the woman who had a panic button clipped on her belt, she worked in Eganville, which is the community, right in the middle of Renfrew County, and his partner assault program, which you basically, these men are sort of court ordered to go to and to deal with their violence and to rehabilitate. That program was directly across the street from her workplace, and he was ordered to go there and get, you know, his rehabilitation done. And she was frightened to go to work. He never showed up at that response program, but she wasn't notified that he wasn't going to show up. You know, and then another woman that he was convicted of assaulting, he was in jail, and she was never notified that he was out of jail and back in the community. Like, there are a lot of places that, you know, this could have been done so much better. And also, the point I make in the piece, too, is a lot of the onus is on the women to protect themselves instead of the men, you know, being sort of subject to being taken a lot more seriously, to put it that way, in the justice system, and being seen as a dangerous person. But there's also civil liberties issues, too, right? Like, yes, he had assaulted this woman this one time, and he went to jail for it, so he served his time, conceivably. You know, are you going to put him away to prevent him from doing crime? Like, we don't have a crystal ball. We can't see for sure that he's going to kill three women in the span of a few hours. But there, you know, maybe there could be more done to sort of assess and take those sort of dangerous signs more seriously.
Well, and not only, I mean, are we maybe not doing more in re-examining these laws and re-examining the ways we deal with domestic violence, and especially repeated domestic violence? Mm-hmm. The stuff that's in place right now is not working. Like you mentioned, he was let out of prison, and he just refused to sign the agreement saying he'd stay away from his victim, and then still just was let out of prison. And as you mentioned, less than a year later, three women are dead. I mean, why are you released from prison when you're not, you know, signing the paperwork that says, well, and does that matter? Obviously, he was not. I don't know what that is. Well, it's a blatant disregard, though. It's a blatant disregard.
Yeah, like, and just the resistance to authority and just, like, basically, screw you. I'm going to do what I want. And, you know, and so, you know, we certainly had questions for the Ontario, you know, Justice Department about that. And they said that even if they don't sign that paper, they still are subject to, you know, they're still not supposed to be anywhere near that, their victim. But, you know, it's just a piece of paper. As the women in the local sexual assault center said to me, it doesn't matter. They can just, you know, defy any of those orders. And I think a big issue, and I talked about this in the piece too, is the probation officer's workload. Not that one probation officer can stop everything from happening, but in terms of the system that we have in place for keeping track of people. And the challenge, too, is this guy was very charming, you know, and if we're in the mindset where we're like, okay, we want people to be rehabilitated and back into society and, you know, lessening their risk of recidivism, you know, we still, I don't know, like these probation officers have, like, you know, huge caseloads, and there's only a few of them in Renfrew County, in rural areas. Particularly, the resources for rural areas is really, really scant, because, you know, it has to do with, like, per capita taxpayers. You know, there aren't as many people there, so they get fewer services. And I don't know. I don't know if we're doing right by people in rural areas. And also, like, we have to think about societal attitudes, too, and what we sort of let go and what we think is acceptable in terms of how we treat women, how we treat each other. That's another piece of this conversation. That's on all of us. You know, we can vote and make decisions for our governments, but we also need to sort of look around at each other and be a little bit more attuned to the sort of pervasiveness of this kind of violence.
And like you mentioned earlier in the conversation, I mean, why isn't this? I mean, is it that we've been, I mean, talking about it? We've been talking about it for what seems like my entire life, which obviously isn't long enough, and I'm 40, but nothing, it doesn't seem to have invoked any large amounts of change. Like you mentioned in the article, that this case could have been used to be, you know, a huge launching pad to be more attentive to the violence against women. And like you mentioned, you know, we're going to lose another 150 Canadian women because these rates aren't going down. These rates aren't going down. And by the time, if this pattern continues, another 150 Canadian women will have died at the hands of their partners since the murders of these people. I mean, it's still this epidemic that doesn't seem to be getting the attention or the change that is necessary.
Well, I'm hoping that as we talk about sexual violence in the sort of sexual assault and harassment context, which we have been doing for a number of years now, think about how it all sort of began in a new way, in a new era with the Gian Gomeshi stuff. You know, I think this is part of that conversation because it is how you treat and regard women as well. And I think the justice systems, there have been some promising signs in federal government as well, and in the provinces, but I think a lot of it has to go so much further than lip service. It has to really make, like, any policy changes that we make, we have to just demand more of our governments to sort of do more in that respect, but also more of each other, you know. And certainly people are of different minds about the, you know, what sort of the government should be doing or not doing in our lives, you know. But at the same time, we can sort of make those decisions and look around and try to, you know. And the reason that I talked about the beginning of Basil Baruch's history with women and his history with these women in particular that he killed was just to show that these guys can be really charming at a time, but then over time they isolate their victims. You know, they do all these things to sort of manipulate them. I think we need to be better at recognizing that stuff in our own backyards, in our own lives, in our relationships with our, you know, our own spouses or our friends' spouses, like just, and have honest conversations about that. It can feel like, oh, it's none of your business.
Yeah.
There are ways to approach it that are safe, you
what
know,
What are those
respectful.
Ways? What are those ways? Like if it's in a situation like, and I think a few, most of us have been in this situation where we're with a girlfriend or we're listening to a girlfriend tell stories perhaps that are coming from within her relationship or her marriage. The last thing, of course, you want to do is judge them, but how do you kind of, I mean, what exactly do you do if you don't want to accept the behavior? What is the step as the ally to the woman to first?
Well, actually, CanadianWomen.org has a really good facts about violence page that I tweeted during while I was waiting for this verdict to come down. And one of the sections is, what should I do if I think someone's being abused? Yeah. Like, there are ways to maintain the woman's agency, of course, like put her safety first. Don't talk to anyone about abuse in front of the suspected abuser, of course.
Right.
You know, don't even leave like a pamphlet or a voicemail, you know, anything that, you know, he could possibly hear. You know, if she wants to talk, listen to her. Don't sort of like be the one like, this is what you have to do. This is, you know, there's some agency there. If she decides to stay in the relationship, try not to judge her. But because you know that, like, we know the statistics about leaving an abuser is really, really like that's you're at a higher likelihood of getting hurt or killed if that happens. So, you know, sometimes the most valuable thing you can offer a woman who's being abused is your respect and learn about all the emergency services in your community that are available to you, how to get a hold of the local women's shelter or sexual assault center. Talk to them about what you think that you might do in the situation, if you can kind of give them information about the dynamics with anonymity, of course.
Yeah.
Just say, my friend going through this, what do you think? What can I do? You know, I think there's some stuff that we can sort of equip ourselves with, I think.
Because it's hard to
be more aware of this stuff rather than just saying it's not my business.
It's not my business,
whatever.
Right. And it's hard to kind of listen and hear that and then feel not compelled to kind of take over, which is the last thing you want to do. Because if you do continue to, you know, I don't know if it's a couple that you hang out with or friends that you're friends or neighbors, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, I don't want to make it seem like I'm approving of this or that I'm like being complacent in this. But you can't eliminate yourself from her life to eliminate him from yours too, because then you're kind of leaving her high and dry.
Yeah, and I think like you really you know, made a good point about this earlier. It's like these are complicated issues and they are personal and private, but I think if we start looking at them as more societal issues that we all sort of play a role in our, just by being more aware and educated about this stuff, like that goes a huge long way. And having sort of respect for women and their decisions and just being more demanding more of men too in terms of how they treat women in daily life, I think is huge. You know, and I think this broader conversation that we're having is really good for all of those reasons. But we need to know that, like, in, you know, luckily it is not extremely common, but every 6 days to me seems like a huge,
it does. Yeah, it does.
You know, but violence is really underreported, and I think that might change if we sort of do a better job in our police forces and in our governments, but also amongst one another. I think this can really change.
It's a compelling story, and it's complex, like you say, and it is really one to read from Chatelaine.com. And Sarah Bosfeld, we thank you so much again for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me and for wanting to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Anytime, every time. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. It is 9:23. We have more compelling stories coming up for you. Tara Hebblethwaite is heavily involved with Oktoberfest. She is a former Miss Oktoberfest. She has passion for her community and for life and for mental health issues. We're going to talk about that with her coming up at 9:30. Matt Lauer fired by NBC News over inappropriate sexual workplace behavior. The trend continues. And Shania Twain called a tramp. We'll talk about that too. This is the Jennifer Campbell Show, 570 News.
When extreme weather hits, count on the 570 Extreme Weather Center.
Welcome back. We are getting set for the second half hour of the show. And as per Star 570, 519-570-2545. Or you can always call us toll-free at 1-800-570-5715. As mentioned, we're going to talk about a local case, a story from someone probably who you've seen in our community many times. Her name is Tara Hebblethwaite. She's a champion for mental health issues. She's been very, very honest and transparent about her issues with mental health, and she's going to tell us a story about her brother who has been missing for a few years now here from Kitchener-Waterloo. She's going to tell us that story. She's going to talk about its effect on her family and on her community as well after the news next at 9:30 on 570 News.
You can scroll through your selfies all day.
Let me take a selfie.
Or put some actual news in your news feed. Click on 570news.com or go to your app store and download the 570 News app.
Thanks for coming back with us on 570 News and on Rogers Television. We have Tara Hebblethwaite joining us in studio this morning. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. You are very well known in this. James, do you mind pumping up her mic for her there? Thank you. You just made it to make adjustments. The tech department. Thank you, tech department. very well known in our community. You are heavily involved. You were Miss Oktoberfest 2013.
I was.
And you were, and now, of course, are heavily involved with Oktoberfest and many areas of it, not just Miss O. You do the Blooming Affair Fashion
Show. Yes, correct.
So you have really developed quite a extra full-time job.
It actually is almost an extra full-time job. I really need more hours in the day.
And you have such wonderful stories. And so let's start actually from the beginning. Let's talk about you first, and then we'll talk about your brother's story. Mm-hmm. But when you became Miss Oktoberfest, and perhaps I have the timeline incorrect, so please fix it if I do. Mm-hmm. You quickly became an advocate for mental health issues.
Yeah, so it actually was when I passed my crown off. So it didn't start until after I was the ambassador. And the reason being for that is that it was from stigma. So I didn't know how to use my platform correctly. And it wasn't till September, a few weeks before I actually passed my title off to Lindsay Cobb-Flesh, that I witnessed a suicide. The building that I was working in, a boy 18 years old, took his life, and he stepped off the top floor of the building. So seeing that, it kind of broke down all the barriers, everything that I was dealing with. I couldn't process that. So it really kind of broke down walls. And I had to start to learn how to deal with what I was dealing with. And then as I started to grow and to gain perspective and to get my own help and started to really come to terms with what I was dealing with, getting medication, I started to realize that a life was lost in a region because they couldn't get help. So I wanted to try to make sure that since I had this voice, that I was able to hopefully impact at least one life that wouldn't be lost to not being able to reach out in the community and to just know that somebody who's built themselves this, you know, second full-time job of being in the community is somebody who's just like the person to your right or to your left.
And that's the thing isn't it, that this company has always been pretty good at being, you know, raising money, raising awareness where we need to, responding to crisis situations. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that we're different in any way here in Waterloo region than anywhere else where I feel like we're just starting to get to the point where we have real good conversations about mental health and advocacy. And we're seeing people like in positions like you were in, or, you know, people like Michael Lounsdown, who's the Canadian sports reporter, all the kinds of celebrities, Clara Hughes, people coming out to say, this is my struggle too. And we have to reframe this. We have to start thinking about this in ways that don't have that stigma. Mm-hmm. How are we doing at that?
We're doing okay. It's kind of a two-prong, I guess, linear line you want to look at. I listened to a talk done at the annual general meeting for the Waterloo Suicide Coalition, and Brian Larkin said, we're getting more calls than ever. great. People are reaching out. But at the same time, we're getting more calls. And unfortunately, if you look at the graph of suicide in our region, it's not gone down since 2013. It's going up slowly. So there's still work to be done. But, you know, it's great that we're getting these calls. But at the same time, yes, it's because of awareness. But as well, too, it's because it's just not, it's not being reshaped yet.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because even in the way that the media, that we in this job deal with the suicide and the topic, specifically suicide, we don't report suicides.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an unwritten rule that we have had. And often we've framed it as a way that we've told ourselves, this is our way to be respectful to the family. This is our way to perhaps not give someone an idea if somebody is feeling rather precarious about their situation. Yeah. Maybe, you know, if they heard a report on the radio or the television, or in the newspaper of someone taking their life, that might be some sort of trigger or, or warning. But then on the other side of it, you kind of think, like, are we kind of helping with that cloud or that shadow of shame by not telling the truth?
And the thing that I love that you touched about that is that the boy's parents, and they are great friends of mine, and they want me to talk about their son and their short story. It's the Prong family. Paula Prong, in the obituary, you know, usually it's like donations made in, and they put it to the Waterloo Suicide Coalition. They wanted it to start getting known. And in his record, it just said no foul play was detected, and there was no harm done on the side of the company. So it kind of was just left as no here, and it just happened. You know, in that gray area, people could have come to their assumptions. But the thing that Paula wants to know is, yes, my son did take his life, and it's because he did need help. And I had a chance to meet with her actually a year after the incident, and we talked about everything. I told her about the day of the event, and she told me about him. And again, too, even for parents, I mean, she said out of all of her children, she never would have thought it would be him.
It's so hard to hear that from a mom, because then as the surviving family members, there's this guilt. There's this, what I should have, I could have, I would have. When really sometimes people who are suffering have become so good at cloaking that sadness and so good at that, that it's hard. It's hard to put that on yourself, to be that hero, that intervening force that will save the day, when really what we need to do is focus on telling people who are feeling this. You can drop the cloak. We will help, but ask for it too. You know, to let them stop hiding.
And I mean, to me, for months after, I was so upset with myself. I said I had a year with this crown and this public figure position. What if I spoke, you know, a month before? What if I got courage to come out or start using that role as a platform? You know, maybe he might have known that, oh, I worked there, or maybe it might have just kind of, you know, and
yeah,
it's
you
hard.
You carry it.
You do carry it, but that's why I'm such a strong force now. If anyone, you know, asks me, you know, how I'm feeling, if I'm not feeling good, I will straight up tell you, you know, and I have taken a personal day from work, and I've said, I just need a day for my mental health, you know, and it's okay to do that. Your mental health is the driving force behind your physical well being, how you're able to carry on your day. And if it's so important, you know, if you have a brain, you have mental health, and people don't realize that there's a scale. You're good, you're medium, you're bad. Everybody is always on that spectrum, you know, so it's okay. It's part of our daily lives. So why not be able to talk about it? If it's, you know, leaning towards one end, and it's all about communication and really starting to open up about something that is just literally part of every single person. It just varies.
Yeah. And the self-awareness to be able to do that. We talked yesterday to a child psychologist, who was talking about, encouraging children and how do we get them to talk about their feelings and moving beyond happy and sad, moving into places like I'm jealous, identifying those feelings, and how we somehow as human beings, we've decided that feelings that make us uncomfortable are those ones we want to rush through or hide or get rid of really quickly. Because we've been sold this idea that happiness, that we're all going to be happy, we're all here to find happy, and then we just stay there. which we know is, I mean, it's all very fluid, isn't it? Yeah. Sometimes you're going to be happy. Sometimes you're going to be sad. And other times you have to kind of recognize in those times that this is where you are right now.
Yeah.
You got to feel it.
Yeah.
Just feel it. Don't try to make it go away.
Mm-hmm.
But starting so at such a young place with kids, yeah, to give them the words to say, you know, I'm angry. I'm jealous. I'm sad. I'm feeling like I want to hurt somebody. All mm-hmm. of those things, those words are so necessary to, instead of, because we all rock around talking about, oh, I'm fine. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. Even mm-hmm. if it's complete and utter baloney.
Yeah. Well, and it's also teaching youth words not to say or not to associate with. One of the things lately, unfortunately, with yet again another mass shooting down in the States, I remember, I think, hearing on CNN or something that the gentleman escaped from a crazed asylum.
Mm.
You know, and it's just words like that. Like it's a mental health institution, you know?
Yeah.
I do presentations and I do various speeches for Lutherwood Children's Mental Health, and I kind of give the definition of mental health, and you know, the word crazy or insane isn't in there. And then I kind of say, well, why do people have that inception? And I go to the next slide and I'm silent. And I just have hundreds of articles start scrolling that say crazed, mental, insane, crazed killer, you know, escaped from the mental asylum. Like it's all of these words that they associate, and it's on the front cover.
With evil. With evilness, yeah.
And it's, so why do people have such a negative stigma and association to it? And for me too, and another reason why it took me so long was because of that stigma.
Mm-hmm.
But because too, my brother grew up with a mental illness as well. And for me growing up, I associated a lot of negative stigma and just I didn't know how to approach it. To me, I felt nervous sometimes. So, I mean, in that sense, it's like, how do you, even in your own family, you know, you have so many other influences around there that you really need to have people around you start normalizing it.
We're going to talk about your brother and mm-hmm. and this case that and his story coming up. We do need to take a short break. Tara Hebblethwaite is our guest. She is a champion for children's mental health, and she has quite a story to tell about her brother. Coming up after the break on 570 News.
We crowdsource our traffic from the bumper-to-bumper crowd surrounding you.
Real-time traffic solutions from sources across the city and you. Your traffic team is 570 News, Kitchener's breaking news, traffic, and weather station.
We are back and we continue our conversation about mental health and the tough job that comes with being an advocate for mental health and honest about one's own mental health experiences and battles. Tara Hebblethwaite is very active in this community with Oktoberfest, a former Miss Oktoberfest, and we just talked about your experiences with mental health and mental illness and let's go on to this story about your brother. Yesterday, you posted to Facebook, and kind of caught my eye, as it does every year. And you wrote that every year on his birthday, I share this article in hopes that maybe one day someone will find him. Please keep his face in the back of your mind. It would mean the world to all of us. So let's talk about your brother mm-hmm. and his situation. And then, of course, let's get into the story, too, the fact that he's missing and has been mm-hmm. for quite some time.
Yeah, so my brother wasn't always in my life growing up. He was born a lot earlier than me. So when I started my first recollections really of him, even though there's pictures of me and him, you know, as a baby, was going to visit him. You know, it was a long drive to get there. And started to, my mom would start to tell me more is that we're going to down to Whitby in Penetanguishene, where he was down there in a mental institution to help get better for his schizophrenia. So it was always great. I remember we'd always go play ping pong and stuff. Like, it was awesome having this brother.
Something to do.
Yeah. So it was good. And as I started to get to know him more, and, you know, as I grew up and he moved closer to this area and started living around here, he'd always be by the house. He lived with us for a bit. But I really started to kind of learn more about him and a little bit of his past, but as well, you know, I always knew he took medication for schizophrenia. So then I would kind of do my research of it, but then as well, you know, in this media and everything, it was so negative. And the negative connotation to it almost made me afraid kind of my brother. Like, I don't know what he was thinking and everything. And it just kind of was a really weird dynamic. I didn't really know how to approach him, and as well too. And then on the flip side, his medication, which, you know, helped him function. He had a job. He had this beautiful cat. He had his own place. He had a car. It made him so docile. So even though, you know, they were suppressing, you know, his mental health issues, it was almost suppressing him in general. So it was almost hard to communicate. So I felt like I didn't know how to approach the situation as a whole. And I think I kind of lacked as a sister in that sense. And how do you deal with a family member with mental health issues when you don't really know where to reach out, even the community, to know how to approach it?
Yeah, and some of those medications, like you mentioned, so strong.
Yeah.
And that's hard too, isn't it? That it takes away, like you just mentioned, it takes away some of that spirit and that energy, or perhaps that personality, the good parts of that. It's almost like a chemotherapy where it has to kind of drain everything to do its job.
He'd be doing so good. Just, he had everything going for him. You never would even think when you saw him that he was dealing really with anything. You just maybe thought that he was just kind of a docile, chill kind of guy. And but then, you know, think about having this medication that suppresses your brain. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to go on medication, is that I was so afraid that I was going to just be so docile. But then he started to kind of be like, well, I'm going to take one less here and there, and one less, and one less. But then, you know, the schizophrenia starts to kind of come and take over. And in my memory, there's been three times now, or that he's gone off his medication and he wanders. Two times we found him down in the States. He got caught in an incident, and we're able to get a phone call from the police down there. We're able to get him back up into Canada and get him the help he need. And then we'd work on it as a family, and he'd be back to normal. But this last time, again, this would have been about 5 years ago now. He went off his medication again, and we could kind of start to see warning signs. But how are you able to go get somebody to go into a hospital to get help or take medication when they have the legal right not for you to tell them to do that? So he went down into the States again. He's Houdini. I don't know how he keeps getting across the border. He doesn't have a passport. We found him. We got him back over, and we were able to get a warrant to get him into a hospital. We had him in Grand River Hospital, and every single day, myself or my parents would go bring out everything we had as, you know, files, and say, he's going to tell you he's okay. He's so smart when he's schizophrenic. Like, it's so beautiful, these people's minds, what they can do. And we said, he needs to stay here. He needs help. And I'll never forget the sound of my mom's voice when I picked up the phone one day, and she just, it was like a shrill, like my body has shivers right now of her saying, they let him go. And they let my brother walk right out the front door of Grand River Hospital. And I just remember driving around town. We started to look for him. I think we saw him a few times after that. And then he was just gone. And I was so thankful to be able to have parents within law enforcement as police officers at the time.
So that's a big, that's an important thing to say too, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That, like, you know, your family had resources. Your father was a police officer. Yeah. Your mother works in the system too.
Yeah.
So this is, you guys, even the people who we would assume have kind of an in.
We don't.
Still, it's still a desperately hard thing to navigate.
Yeah. I mean, it was great because, you know, my dad could say to his whole entire shift or office, you know, here's a picture, keep him in your mind. But the police don't have the resources. And I'm so thankful for Maureen Trask and her fight with Catherine Fife in this region to push forth with the Missing Persons Act, which just got actually in this month. It went into legislation and hopefully will pass to help give the police more ability to actually do an investigation. And the huge thing is, if there's no sort of connection to a crime, then they can't do anything. But those 48 hours, 72 hours after somebody starts to go missing, it's so crucial. And how do you know if it's not a crime when you can't even investigate? So it's so hard. It's, I don't know, as a daughter, it's, what do you do? What do you say to your mother to try to make her feel whole? And it's every day. It's, is he alive? Is he not alive? You know, there's no closure. Every day it's wondering where he is. Is he happy? Is he not happy? Is he safe? Is he living on the streets? Does he actually have it all together? Is he taking medication somewhere else? It's so hard to know where to go. And it's just, it's a big question mark. It's a big empty void, and we don't have the resources. Mm-hmm. We just, I'm so thankful for social media, you know, because I'm here right now because of that.
Yeah, yeah, because of your post. Yeah.
Other than that, what do you do? You know, it's, I mean, even the link that I have, it's from the record. The Waterloo Regional Police Service, their website, which she had his post on, it's gone.
And, and again, your father, what is he retired now? Your dad,
is he retired? Yeah.
But still, I mean, connections obviously within the police, and you're right. It all comes down to resources and money, which is so heartbreaking when we're talking about people's lives here, and we're talking about, you know, like you mentioned, people's brothers and your mom's situation. Speak to that too, if you can, just for a second. Talk about your mom, because you just told me this, you know, compelling story. And I think this is what helps people is when we tell our stories. When we tell our stories, you know, other people can, maybe they're driving thinking, oh my God, oh my goodness, me too. Oh my goodness, you get it. I feel like you're talking to me right now. Yeah. And I think that is the part. That's the resource that we can use.
Yeah.
That's the resource that kind of, you know, we have at our fingertips that we can use. But talk about your mom's situation, because you have such empathy in your heart for her. And I think that's an important piece of the story.
And she goes to work every day. She's still with the offender transport unit for the OPP. And for her to go to work every day, she's dealing with prisoners. A lot of these prisoners are prisoners who have a mental health issue. So my mom is having to see a lot of maybe her son and a lot of these people and having to help them or having to stay strong and to be able to still do her job. But yet I can only imagine how many similarities there is that links to her son of things that she's seen. Or every day we go to work, you know, the police send out, you know, we have a missing person or we have unidentified remains. We have
she just must get into every single time that happens, every single time.
Yeah.
It's just so front and center for her.
Yeah, and again, she's still with the force, you know?
Yeah, she's still doing that job.
And the thing is, though, even the, like, my mom can't just go and start looking. There's laws. There's, like, you can't do that. So even in that position, we're not better off than anyone else, you know, left or right, no matter what the job is. It's just, right now, the laws and the legislation, the help out there for missing people is not, it's not prevalent. Other provinces, like British Columbia, they have this in a place where if a missing person goes, they can get a judge order to go into phone records and start tracking. The resources are out there, but Ontario really needs it because there's families, people suffering, missing sons, daughters, you know, siblings. It's a really empty void that it's you don't really know how to fill it until you have some sort of answer.
Yeah, and it's, you know, when you talk about how do you help and how do you kind of, you know, serve your family members, because you're struggling with your loss of relationship with your brother. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a different thing for your mom. Yeah. She's concerned about where her son is and if he's okay. And together collectively as a family, even when you're all there for each other, it's a different relationship that you're kind of grieving or mourning or wondering about. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that same desperate feeling, but that's sometimes you can just get in the hole with somebody, I guess is what my point is. You can't fix it.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do. You can just get in the hole with the person, you know? Yeah.
And I guess my biggest thing now is if I couldn't do anything then and I wasn't able to be a sister to kind of use my voice at that time or to really know how to connect, at least what I do now with mental health. It's for Ian, it's for my brother, it's for my family, it's for those who need to hear it. And, I just hope one day we have some sort of answer.
So I will share, this story. Like you mentioned, it is years old, with the photo of your brother. Do you want people if anybody's hearing this and it's kind of, you know, jogging something or they are thinking about something,
sure.
Do they contact you? What do they do?
Yeah.
The police?
If you have like on my Facebook, just, or to the police too, like in the record, it tells you what a phone number to call, but just anything. He's been known to go to Windsor, Manitoba, down in the States. So if anyone's out there, it's all sharing. It's all
sharing. Yep.
He has a face that you, when you see it, you can't forget. So
striking blue eyes.
Yes.
Just like his sister. Thanks for sharing that story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tara Hebblethwaite is a champion in this community and for mental health. And we thank you so much for your time this morning. Thank you. Bye-bye. And Mike Farwell is just moments away. I thank you for your time and we will talk again tomorrow morning.